Hi, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Follow me on Twitter, @RyanBallingy. You can visit us on our website, golfnewsnet.com, or find my work on Yahoo Sports, sports.yahoo.com, on the Devil Ball Golf blog. You can also follow Golf News Net on Twitter and Facebook, twitter.com and facebook.com/golfnewsnet. If you're a subscriber to this show via iTunes or another podcasting service, thanks so much for being a subscriber. Please check out Golf News Net Radio, which is a 24/7 stream of golf talk that we think you'll really enjoy. You can find it on our website, golfnewsnet.com, our on-demand site, golfnewsradio.com, or on the TuneIn Radio app. I had originally intended to record this show as a fully-fledged usual monologue, basically, between you and I, with me doing all of the talking on a particular topic or couple throughout 25 or 26 minutes. But then I had the opportunity this morning to speak with Michael Bamberger from Sports Illustrated. Michael is one of my writing idols. I love reading everything that I can of his. And I had the opportunity to read his forthcoming book coming out in time for the Masters called Men in Green. And immediately after finishing the book, I got in touch with Michael, who was kind enough to send me a note along with the book, and imploring him to have a conversation about it, 15 to 20 minutes, I thought it would be. Ultimately, it turned out to be about a 35 to 37 minute conversation about the book that really features interviews and time spent and learning about 18 different people that he considers legends or that are outright considered legends in the game. And I love the conversation so much. I thought it was one of the best I've ever had about golf with a single person, or even a group of people for that matter, that I wanted to share it with you as the podcast this week in lieu of having a conversation with you about a topic in the game. Believe it or not, this show used to actually have guests. It actually also used to be 2 hours. So we used to have to fill a lot of time and had a lot of wonderful people on the show over the years, but it's hard for me to say that there was a guest that was better than Michael Bamberger. So without ado, I present the conversation I had with Michael this morning, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Michael Bamberger joins us. He's one of my favorite writers, and he should be one of yours too. He works at Sports Illustrated, and he's come out with a new book that is an absolutely fantastic read, and that's why he's here to join us. It's called Men in Green. And Michael, thanks for being with us, first of all, but can you give folks, for people who haven't had a chance to read this yet, or have heard of the book yet, the impetus behind the book and exactly how long this journey took you?
Sure, Ryan. It's a delight to be on here with you. And the book is a travel story, really. A friend and I, Mike Donald, who Brian would know that name, but many listeners would not. He played the tour for years. He was the runner-up in the 1990 U.S. Open. He lost in an epic 19-hole playoff to Hale Irwin. He's a close friend of mine, and he and I went around the country and saw all these icons of the game who really got their feet wet or were deeply immersed in the game going back to the 70s, which is when I first fell for golf, which was a wild, interesting decade. And along the way, at one point early on, I made this list of 18 legends that I wanted to see. And then went out and tried to see all of them. Ryan, if you like, I'll play a little quiz game because I've not found anybody yet who has shaken hands with all 18 of my legends. You want to try this out, Ryan?
All right.
I'll give you the names. You just give me yes or no if you've ever shaken their hands.
Okay.
Arnold Palmer.
Yes.
Jack Nicklaus.
Yes.
Ken Venturi.
No.
Tom Watson.
Yes.
Curtis Strange.
No.
Fred Couples.
No.
Ben Crenshaw.
Yes.
Dale Irwin.
Yes.
Sandy Tatum.
No.
Do you know who he is?
I do.
Former USGA president from the 70s, now about 94 years old. Unbelievably short. Well, those are my living legends I just gave you. And then now I'll run through the S. Jaime Diaz.
Yes.
Who's Jaime?
Jaime is the absolute best at, let's see, is he editor-in-chief still of Golf World?
Yes. Yes. He is the best. And I love how you pronounce his first name. Jaime, that's the original traditional pronunciation. Billy Harmon?
No.
You know who he is?
I know who he is. He's kind of part of the Harmon clan, but he's the one who's probably the best partier of the bunch.
Yes, you nailed it. Brian, how about Neil Oxman? Do you know that name?
It didn't ring a bell until you had brought it up in the book.
Neil Oxman's caddy. Now, here's one that he's this one. You're too young. Golf ball, the caddy built his hole.
I had never met him, but I really desperately want to after reading the book.
Yeah, he's the best, fascinating guy. Randy Erskine, you probably wouldn't know. He's a Club Pro in Michigan.
Yeah, I don't know him, but...
Cliff Danley is before your time. He ran the Honda tournament for years. You may have met him. Cliff Danley, do you know him?
I never met him. Most of the time I worked with Ken Kennerly whenever I've kind of dealt with anyone in Honda.
Yes, that's right. More recent years you would have. Chuck Will is an absolute secret legend. I'd be really surprised if you've met him.
No.
He's been away from the game for a long time. But do you know the name Frank Cherkinian?
Yes, I do.
Well, Chuck Will was Frank Cherkinian's friend. Frank Cherkinian, for those who don't know that name, is a Hall of Fame member who was a pioneering producer of golf for CBS Sports. And every person like that needs a deputy, and Chuck Will is his deputy. And then the ninth and last of my secret legends is my friend Mike Donald, who's the guy who came around with me. I've met a bunch of people, including Mike Donald, and myself, where we've met 17 of the 18, but I've never shaken hands with Mickey Wright, which I'm really eager to do. But I don't think it's ever going to happen because she's doing her own thing her own way.
Mickey Wright was one of the most fascinating kind of, investigative missions, so to speak, to try to figure out where on earth she was, what on earth she was doing, and why she doesn't have much connection to the game of golf these days. But you finally get a hold of her in some capacity toward the tail end of the book. Did you feel like you got what you wanted out of Mickey Wright, knowing probably going into it that you weren't going to get a whole lot?
Yes, you worded that perfectly. Yes, given what I knew, she's done talking about golf. You know, she's moved on from golf. And people want to say Mickey Wright, for those who wouldn't even know the name, is the Ben Hogan of women's golf. She absolutely dominated the game from, let's say, roughly 56 until, let's say, about 65. She won numerous U.S. Opens, LPGA championships, and the title holders, which was a great major event on the LPGA schedule. And when she walked away from the game, she really walked away. When she had a room named for her in the USGA Museum, she didn't come to the opening. When they had the 50th anniversary of the LPGA years ago at the Breakers Hotel, only about an hour from the house, she didn't come to that. When she was honored by the USGA with the Bob Jones Award, she didn't come to that. So she has really stepped away from the game. People want to say, oh, she's some sort of reckless, but she's not. What she just has is she's moved on from golf, and she's living a different kind of life now. So yes, Ryan, just like you said, when I tried to engage her in a golf conversation, she's like, hey, I've had enough of that, really. I don't want to do it. But when the conversation was more like, could we talk about friendships that you've made through golf, then she was a little bit much more willing, at least to talk to me on the phone, not see me in person, talk to me on the phone. She's a fantastic, fascinating person, and unique.
And I find it so interesting that because she was so dominant and had such a pure golf swing, I mean, it's just a gorgeous thing to watch. But her memory, the way people remember her, will be more or less limited to tournament results because she just doesn't want to talk about it. Do you have some educated guess as to perhaps why that is, why she's chosen that way to be remembered?
You worded that in a very interesting way. I think the answer is implied in the way you worded your question. People will remember her for this. People will remember her for that. I don't think she really cares. She knows what she did. She doesn't. Her ego doesn't need the gratification of knowing that hundreds of millions or billions of people still remember. If you go to her locker at the Golf Hall of Fame, where people cram all sorts of stuff in there, she's got one thing in there. It's her book, Playing Golf the Right Way. So if she's got a legacy, it's like, play golf the right way. And a good starting point would be her own book. I think it would take an unusually selfless person to be able to say, I don't really care if you need to know about me. Put up the record, speaks for itself.
I can't think of it. I'm sure you've probably done this exercise. I can't think of another person in golf that is as highly regarded competitively that has done that or would do that. I mean, I think maybe the closest thing I can think of off the top of my head is Bobby Jones just saying, my record speaks for itself. I can walk away a happy man. But it's not like he stepped away from the game entirely, unlike Mickey Wright, who not disavows golf, but doesn't play it, isn't really involved with it.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And when I mentioned that to Arnold at one point, that Mickey doesn't play anymore, he was like, they're contemporaries. They dominated the game the exact same time. He was like, I can't believe that. Because Arnold loves golf so much, loves to play so much, and loves to be around people so much. But it just goes to show you, it takes all sorts of people in this world to make the world go around. You're right, there's something unique in her composition by which she is saying, I don't need it. And obviously she means it.
Yeah.
Because she didn't show up to collect the Bob Jones Award from the USGA. It meant a lot to her, but she didn't need to be seen in public, didn't want to be seen in public, except she was in a different stage in her life.
You mentioned Arnold Palmer a second ago, and I know you mentioned in the book a couple times the question, at what point in life were you the happiest? And I think it's a great question, but I wonder if when Arnold kind of gave you the answer that he's still got things that he's not happy about in his life, but of anyone that you met with and had time with for this book, do you think Arnold Palmer is the happiest?
Wow, really, really hard question. I don't think I would be in a position to judge happiness of other people because it's so intensely personal. But I'll say this about Arnold. It takes an unusual level of honesty. Here's the question, Arnold. Are you satisfied with where your life is right now? And he says, this is very near the end of the book. And he says, no, like that. And it's such an honest statement. And what does it mean? It means he wishes he was 36, you know, contending at Augusta and U.S. Opens again and flying around on that jet and being in the thick of the excitement. And why not? That was a great period. But you have other people when they're in that stage of their life that said, and Mickey Wright would be one of them, you know, I had my day and my day was great, but I moved on. And so that, you know, this book is intensely personal. I feel incredibly fortunate that people like Arnold and Mickey and Sandy Tatum and Golfball and various others were willing to be so open with me. And if this book is really about anything, one thing I would say, well, in part, it's about the aging process, how we age and how we accept it and or don't accept it, and the honesty with which we face ourselves. You're asking a really interesting question, but I don't know how to answer it. But I will say that when Mike Donald and I went to visit Golfball, like this retired caddy who's living in a nursing home in Jackson, Mississippi, who doesn't have any use of his legs now, he had so much goodwill stored toward golf and towards Raymond Floyd and Calvin Peet and other people for whom he caddied, that there was a profound depth to the man, you know, just, you know, without having the advantage of an education or anything else, without having the advantage of an education, formal education, probably ended, you know, in high school, I would think. But there was a deepness to the man and a wisdom that was fascinating and a little bit heartbreaking, but you know, gratifying to hear as well.
One of the other themes that I assume this is purely unintentional, just kind of in the course of discovery, the book kind of took this turn. But I feel like one of the other themes is the legend of stories in golf, of just how true everything we've been told over the years is kind of golf's legend, is fact or fiction or somewhere in between. And you kind of mentioned it with Golfball a little bit, but it also comes up rather frequently and almost tragically about Ken Venturi. And the book kind of takes a turn at a point where I started reading about your initial encounter, your initial time with Ken Venturi, And then as the book goes on, it gets sadder and sadder as some of the aspects about many of the aspects of the stories that he told over the years that, that probably a lot of people had committed to memory and tell other people about weren't really all that true. So I guess what, in the end, what did you try to communicate about Ken Venturi through the book, and how did your feeling about him change over the course of writing the book?
Are you this good every day? These are great questions. That's very that's very insightful, because I started with Ken in the book at one point where Mike and I went out to see him, and we had a great dinner that went on, and I met Ken several times before that, and I knew him a little bit, and I helped him do some ghostwriting. And this man was truly charismatic. It's exciting to be in the presence of Ken Venturi. And when he tells you a Hogan story or a Nelson story or a story from the Masters in the 50s, I mean, you're getting it from the source. He was there, and it's exciting to hear. And then, tragically, he died before, just after he got to the Hall of Fame, but he was too ill to attend his own Hall of Fame induction. And then I checked out some of his stories to see how they held up, and many of them did. And one that people know about, I think people know about, he wrote about it in his own book, is he basically accused, he never won Augusta. He had three great chances to win it in 56, 58, and 60. And didn't win. 56, he would have been an amateur, shot an 80 in the last round and didn't win. And then he, and then his career ended shortly because of injuries, carpal tunnel syndrome, and other things. He lost his game. And then he had this long second act as a CBS anchor that many, many of us would remember. I'm sure you do, Ryan. Yeah. And he went back to Augusta every year. And he brought something to those Augusta telecasts that are way beyond words. I mean, he wasn't particularly gifted as an orator. In fact, he struggled with a stutter his whole life. But there was an emotional connection that he had to that golf course and to that tournament that transcended words, and I think it had a lot to do with the greatness and the popularity of the Masters. But, and this is the big but, what are the roots of the feelings? And the roots of the feelings were, he felt robbed that he never had the chance, that he didn't close the deal in his various chances to win the Masters. He would have loved to have been the guy in the green coat. And one of his, as he started casting about trying to figure out why he never won the Masters, he developed, I think, I'm giving you my theory here, later in life, this theory that Arnold was not really the rightful winner of the 1958 Masters when Ken finished two shots behind him. Because of an incident which has now become famous deep in the lore of the game. Many people wouldn't know that, but some would. Regarding an episode where Arnold dropped a second ball after an embedded ball over the 12th green in the Sunday round of the 58 Masters. And without going through the whole thing right now, it got embedded deep in his head. I think Ken got confused about what really the rule was then when Arnold played the shot and what the rule became later. And but it got all sort of twisted up in his head. And so, yes, in a sense, you got a little bit of a psychological study of what was going on in Ken's mind regarding Augusta and by extension, Arnold Palmer and various other things in his life. But I don't think it's uncommon at all that we play, all of us, games in our head to justify the things that have happened in our life. So I don't write with any rancor whatsoever over who Ken was or why he did what he did. I just try to explore it.
Yeah, and you do it expertly, because it would be very easy to almost label Ken Venturi not a liar, but at least an aggrandizer, a guy who takes things and makes them bigger than they are. And when he talked about winning the U.S. Open and after the U.S. Open and stories after that, and then you kind of go down the line and there's doubt cast. There's not necessarily an absolute bookshot, because Ken Venturi isn't alive to defend his own storytelling. But there's a lot of doubt there about so many things that he said happened as he won the Open, after he won the Open at Congressional, and it really made me sad. And I guess at the end, of at least his portion of the book, where you ask Ray Floyd, who told people that Ken said, "My God, I've won the Open," when he had battled dehydration and could have died out there at Congressional that day. And he said, I didn't. So,
yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, if he didn't say it, then who propagated the legend? And the only guy who could have done it, really, was Ken Venturi. So did he say it or not? And we don't know. And I think in reading that entire book, that was where my heart broke most, was that I don't know if that line that I really love, that movie-grade line, is true.
Yeah, Brian, I hear you, and I'm with you. I asked Ken how that quote got out. I asked Floyd if he heard it. He said no. And I asked Ken how that quote got out to the world, and he said he didn't know. And you're right. I mean, some of the things that have been handed down to us are, it's like a movie. It's just as you said, it's like a movie. And, well, we love movies, but real life isn't a movie.
Yeah.
And if you compare Ken and Arnold Palmer, Arnold, in my experience, never aggrandizes, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, anything. He just tells it like it is. And he's comfortable with who he is. He doesn't have to pretend to be anything more than who he is, because he did it all. He did everything he wanted to do. Oh, maybe not. He would have won a PGA Championship and the U.S. Opens for sure. But he doesn't have the need to exaggerate anything. So, yeah, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to ask yourself, what is it in Ken's personality that would not allow him to really celebrate the things that he did accomplish, like a 30-plus year career at CBS, where he was a beloved announcer, winning one of the most famous U.S. Opens of all time, being in contention 3 times at Augusta National. I mean, who would love to have been in contention 3 times at Augusta National? But there was something, in my opinion, I'm not claiming any of this respect either, but in my opinion, there was something in his personality that prevented him from really, truly getting the satisfaction that we wish he might have out of his successes, and instead focusing more on things that he didn't get, like that green coat.
Yeah, I think you really put it well at one point where you're talking about he just couldn't let it go. He just couldn't move on, and that kept his entire life. It almost kind of stuck in 1958 or 1956, for that matter, and maybe that's where his mind stayed for an awfully long time.
Well, 56 especially, because 56, had he won as an amateur, and by the way, can you believe, nearly 6 years later, we're talking about the 1956 Masters.
Yeah.
That's incredible, really. But had he won in 56 as an amateur, in his mind, he would have become a Augusta National member. He would have stayed amateur for life. He would have had, a well-paying job as an executive at Ford. And he would have loved the life of Francis We Met and Bobby Jones. And it would have been
amazing.
Amazing, yeah. It would have been a dream. And he didn't get that dream. So he got something else. But yeah, you're right. People are complicated. And I could have written a whole book just trying to figure out Ken Venturi, but went in other directions.
What group of the legends, the obvious, the living legends or the secret legends, did you enjoy speaking with more?
Oh, wow. Every single one of them. Every person I got to spend one-on-one time with, was a total joy. But I would say the reporter in me finds it much more interesting to uncover an unknown person than to write again about a known person. But I do feel like some of these well-known people, like Arnold particularly, I had a chance to write about them in a way that they're not typically written about. But always what's fresh and unknown is the most exciting thing, I think, to any reporter. And I would say in that regard, probably the guy who's come up a few times here in this conversation would be Golf
Saturday in the for a week in 79, just a little bit in 85 and 86, and then later in 91, but that was on the European tour. I got to see a golf ball in action, and he was scary. There was something scary about the guy, and I kept my distance from him, but I was in awe of him as well. And then when Mike and I went to see him, he was way different than I imagined, and I could also see that he was a brilliant person, and that had he had the benefit of an education, there's no saying what he might have done with his life. But in other words, his understanding of people and the human condition, how frail it all is and how quickly it all goes, was actually on a profound level. You know, his conversation would never be so, you would never sound as pretentious as I sound now talking about his own life, ever. I mean, he doesn't have that in him, but it's true. He had insight into himself, into Raymond Floyd, into their relationship, into Ben Crenshaw's relationship with his first wife, and why that first wife, now divorced, has moved back to Austin, and what that might mean for Ben. I mean, in other words, what I'm trying to say is the depth of empathy that this man has for other people is unusual, and I had no idea it was there until Mike and I went to see him that day.
You touched on this a little bit in talking about golf ball, but the other really sticky concept of this book with me was something Arnold said very early about the edge, losing the edge, and that maybe winning the 1960 U.S. Open cost him the edge. And I thought that was a pretty stunning admission, given that he still had another 7 to 8 really good years of golf in front of him. Do you think he really did lose the edge when he won the 60 Open, or do you think that maybe, not that he overstated it a little bit, just that, I don't know, that maybe looking back on it, he had more clarity about his professional career?
Wow, really well worded. Really, really well worded, because if people get into the book, they'll see this. Arnold Palmer won the 1960 U.S. Open very famously in a tournament where Hogan and Nicklaus and many other greats were, at the peak of the powers or rising to it or, hanging on like Hogan was that period. He had an unbelievable career after that, including, let's see, the 62 and 64 Masters, 2 British Opens, and dozens of PGA Tour wins. So he's going to say right now in his mid-80s, yeah, but at that 1960 U.S. Open, I lost the edge. And you're going to say, huh? What do you mean you lost the edge? What about all the other great things you accomplished afterwards? And he's going to tell you now that, I believe this is how he would articulate it, the U.S. Open was the tournament that meant the most to him. He was the son of a greenkeeper in Latrobe, PA. There really were no other events. There was the National Open, and he won his National Open at a relatively young age, 5-6 years into his pro career. And in his mind, the tournament that meant the most to him, he couldn't summon it up. He couldn't go deep enough to get what he needed to win the championship that meant the most to him when he wants it. So, I think it's just, when he says, I lost the edge, I think it's in his mind that he lost the edge. And he's looking back and he's like, why couldn't I close the deal on those 3 playoffs and the U.S. Opens that I lost and other U.S. Opens where I was contending for 54, for 63 holes, for 370 holes? And I think that's what he's come up with, is that in that 1960 U.S. Open, after I won it, the insatiable hunger for winning other U.S. Opens was gone. It didn't seem to affect him in other terms, but it did affect him in the one that meant the most to him. And it would be hard for people, our age and younger, especially my age or your age or younger, because now the Masters is such an important tournament. The Masters made Arnold Palmer in a lot of ways. It made CBS and Arnold and the Masters sort of all came up together. But what he's telling you is, Jack Nicklaus says the same thing. It was a great invitational event. It meant a lot to all of us. But the U.S. Open was our national championship, and it meant by far the most.
Do you think Mr. Palmer still thinks about the Open with Billy Casper or other chances that slipped away? Do you think that comes up in his mind, not daily, but that he thinks about the losses with some regularity?
Well, I wouldn't know the answer, but I do know that if you bring it up with him and he's in the mood to talk about it, he can go deep on any of those playoffs. Mm. So whether he thinks about it daily or not, I don't know, but I think it's deeply embedded to him, which shows you how competitive it is and how much he loved the action, and that he's a ruminative person. Arnold is such a thinking person, I think probably more so than, you know, anyone who just knows him from the ICT and, you know, seeing him as ads might ever realize. But there's a wisdom and a profound depth to Arnold that I didn't know was there until, even though I'd been around Arnold a little bit, you know, for a lot of years, but, you know, totally after his prime, but, you know, just dipping here. But it wasn't really until I could just spend, you know, time with him for this book that I think I got a little more insight into the depth of the man, and that it's no accident that he became Arnold Palmer.
Yeah. Two final questions for you, Michael. One, do you think Arnold Palmer ever opened the letter you gave to him from Ken Venturi's widow? Ex-wife.
Brian, I'm going to pass on that question, even though I could answer the question. I just think it's so personal that I'd rather not get into it.
I understand. So we'll end on this. Do you feel like you got closer to Mike Donald over the course of this journey, and how is he doing now?
Well, that's a beautiful question, Ryan. I appreciate that question a lot. Yeah, I first met Mike in 1985 at the Honda tournament. I was caddying, and he was playing in the group. I was caddying for Brad Faxon, and he was playing in Brad's group. And I would see him around as a caddy, and I caddied some for a very close friend of his, Billy Britton, from Staten Island. In 1995, which would have been the fifth year anniversary of his playoff loss in the U.S. Open, I wrote about him. And it was really after that we started becoming much closer. We're really different people in many, many, many ways, and we're really similar people in other ways. And we've been close friends for a long time. We've logged a lot of rounds together and a lot of meals and a lot of really great conversations. And he's been a really good friend for a long time. But I don't think there's any question that the experience of going around and seeing these people and then analyzing what they said and revisiting it all, made us closer friends. And I treasure Mike as a friend, and I'm so grateful to have my life. And, I've probably learned as much from Mike as anybody in my life, you know, except for maybe, you know, my brother, my father. But there's a, like Arnold and like golf ball, there's a depth to Mike that I hope people will see, or at least get a hint of, in this book, but, you know, that I know personally. And, so yes, the answer is an emphatic yes to your question, and, he's enriched my life more than I could say.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for spending, it was a half hour, but felt like 5 minutes with us. I love this book, and I hope there's a possibility of a sequel someday in some variation, because it was that wonderful.
Well, you're very nice, Ryan. You asked a lot of good questions, and I appreciate the thought with which you read the book and asked these questions, so it was really a pleasure, so thank you, Ryan.
Men in Green is available. Check it out if you have, you can do it through Apple, you can do it through Amazon, pretty much anywhere you can get a book, digital or published. And
including your local library, I hope. You know, I'm not trying to sell anything here. If people want to get it at the library, that would be fine by me.
Just get your hands on it and read it. It'll be probably the quickest 2 hours of your life, and you'll want to read it again and again, because it's just that good. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael Bamberger. Again, the book is Men in Green. It's available through all of your booksellers, published either digitally or in the good old paper version. You can also, as Michael alluded to, hopefully find it in a library near you soon, so you don't have to buy the book, just so long as you enjoy it. Okay, so please email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Let me know if you enjoyed the interview, if you'd like to hear from more folks like Michael in the future. I love doing interviews. It's just something we not... are typically doing for this podcast, but I love to have great golf conversations. Follow me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. You can also follow me on Facebook through Golf News Net, facebook.com/golfnewsnet. Next week on the show, we'll talk Masters, and we'll get you ready for the year's first major as we broadcast remotely from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Until next time, I'm Ryan Ballingy saying thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.